Hey, did you hear the joke about the latest graphics card to come out? I was going to tell you, but I figured there's no way you'd ever get it anyway. Hey, howdy, 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 ho. It's Daniel Markham here with the DanielBMarkham.com Nerd Roundup. If you've never been to a Nerd Roundup before, we're welcome to be here. However, this is a complete waste of your time, and I recommend you do something else, like study to be a doctor or something. Nerd Roundup is we get together every week, talk about technical stories of the week from a nerdy standpoint. We do a lot of programming, science, politics of science. No topic's really off limits. Why do I do this? Is it part of some master plan to make billions of dollars? No, it is not. Actually, the reason we do this is that it's important for a team to relax, joke, and talk about dang near anything in life. I think teams that relax together can kick ass. And the only way I know how to show you how to do that is just to do it right here in front of you. So this week we've got sort of a lighter crowd of John Kern. John, hello.
Hello, Daniel. Merry
So,
Christmas, almost Happy New Year.
yeah, it's a holiday season, Hanukkah, Christmas, New Year. I think Kwanzaa was early December. There's been a plethora of things to celebrate in the last month or so.
And the people in the northern state above us, like they do some kind of boxing?
Yeah,
I don't know.
it's a sad thing. The Canadians have been known to drink a little more than they should at times, and so the day after Christmas is the traditional Boxing Day for Canadians, when they come into the street and pummel one another when they're upset that their presents were not good enough. So if you know a Canadian, and they're looking okay this week, it's probably they have a pretty good left hook.
Yet, I always felt Canadians were way more polite, so that's so strange.
You know what?
Maybe that's why curling is so popular, because there's no way you can throw a curling stone at somebody.
I worked in Canada. My friends kept saying that they were going to watch curling. They were going to go curling, and all I knew curling from was weightlifting. I was like, wow, this must really be slow for them to go watch people do curls. It's oof. I finally asked my boss. I said, "What's curling good for?" And he said, "A lower back injury."
I will say one matter of fact, after the Agile Manifesto weekend ended, I flew to Sutton, Canada, which is north of Vermont, southeast of Montreal, and to meet my family, who drove up there with another family friends for skiing. It's a nice little Mount Sutton is a beautiful little ski area, not hoity-toity like near Montreal. So it was a pattern that we were fortunate to do a few times over many years. And there was one season we were up there with the kids, and it was really windy. So, all right, and we were with some friends. Let's not go skiing today. And I said, oh, there's like a curling club in town. Let's go see if they're open. I would love to drink beer and do curling, especially the drink beer part, because it just looks like a hilarious sport to be sitting there being really bad at it and drinking some beer and walking on the ice and then doing it and then drinking some beer while it's going down, and people are doing that. But it was closed, so I never did go curling, but I would love to try it. But I did read about it. I should have put some articles in there. It's super fascinating physics that's somewhat controversial. So I had nothing but time on my hands while we were up there staying. We always stayed in this really tiny auberge with like 14 rooms. It was like staying with your older brother and his wife or something, right? Really collegial. And you had a fireplace, you start a fire, then you had six beers in about a 2 meter long bar that you could just help yourself. And so it really was like staying with family, because we'd been, it seemed like the girls grew up there. And I remember researching it, and it's fascinating technology. The stones only come from one place. They're incredibly, like some quarry in Scotland, if I recall. And then there's a separate type of stone on the bottom. Of course, they're incredibly specified and quality controlled, like insane. And then it's the whole, when the thing is rotating, which way does it go? Yeah. You know, and then why? And so there's, you know, I stumbled into physics papers because you probably learned about regulation, where like an ice skate, you know, or like a music wire with weights hanging on it, it will go through ice and then it'll reseal behind it.
Yes.
Because of the pressure. Anyway, it was a funny, very nerd roundup type journey. I should dig up some articles for January.
You know, come to think of it, I've read 3 articles in the last 10 years or so on why is ice slippery, which you think would be an easy thing to answer. And I think each article had a sort of a different answer. Part of it's the part where you press down on something, it melts temporarily. Part of it's the water. I think they're still struggling with just a simple, why is ice slick?
That's really fascinating. I never thought about that. Because they probably can explain why oil is slippery, you know. But yeah, like why is, yeah.
Water's a sort of an amazing thing because it's got the triple point where they're freasing, solid, and gaseous all within a very small range of one another. It actually has, it gets less dense when it freezes at first and then gets more dense later on. It has all these odd properties that we're still struggling with. And if water didn't have, you know, property like, say, ice floating, you know, we probably wouldn't be here because the ponds would freeze from the bottom up.
Right, because that allows the surface to form and the water below it to stay thawed and animals to live underneath it. Yeah, if it had formed on the bottom of the water. So yeah, that's kind of fascinating.
So I'm of the opinion that curling probably is one of the most scientifically interesting sports. And also, what happens if you drink too much beer and live in the north? Right, so both of those things can be true at the same time. And I went to a curling club once myself, had a beer. Nobody was actually engaged in the curling, but it was a weird, you're right, they're clubs. They don't have like a bowling alley. They don't have that I know of. They didn't have a curling alley. You went to the club, you had like a little spot where you could drink, and then there was a glass and you could oversee the lanes, I guess they call them.
Oh, cool. So all I got to was the outside door. So that was only a figment of my imagination, what you just described. I was hoping it was like that, but I had no idea.
I had sort of an image when you were describing it of like actually drinking the beer, going out on the ice while drinking the beer, you know, and saying, hey, that looks pretty hard, you know, but probably would not welcome you to do that.
I just love how slow-mo it is. Yeah, it's like, you know, you're going down, and when you see him with the, I don't want to say puck, whatever the hell you call that thing. And you see him just like going really slow, and then letting it go really slow. Yeah, I think it's a fascinatingly, I'm sure it's challenging as hell.
Yes. And I've seen them like curl or whatever the thing is, so like it goes on the outside and comes swinging back in very, very slowly from the outside. It's like, oh my God, how could you at the beginning of that ever know that that's how you want to play that thing out? It's just wild.
Yeah.
So this week I thought we would do sort of a best of list. I sent out, golly gee, probably 400 or 500 articles we've been over this year. We had a heck of a nerd bunch of roundup articles this week. And so I sent out a list of 500 articles, and you're the only person that came on the next week. So I'm not going to do that again. At least
maybe you scared everyone. Yeah.
Well, I told them if you didn't want to do it, you didn't have to. I just thought it would be kind of weird to do a meta show where you kind of look back on the best of everything. So you sent a few in. I had a few myself, and I figured we'll just kind of kick through them and see what we think of them. This first one is I think this guy's from the Sierra Club, maybe, and he's talking about nuclear power is the best climate change solution by far. I don't even know what to make of this, because, like, this has been true from the 1960s.
Yep.
So it's like, 1 + 1 = 2, math may help us in economics. I read the headline. But, I mean, why in the hell would be, this is just quite a pickle we've gotten ourselves into.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, you know, during the 73 OPEC oil embargo, when the Arabs cut off oil and we were all panicking, some countries did something about that.
France.
We weren't one of them.
France. Yeah, France was.
France went nuclear. I think maybe my memory is probably fuzzy, but Yeah, I want to say France is probably 70 or 80% nuclear. But I think even more funny, so to speak, didn't Brazil or somebody like go like the sugar beet route or something?
I think so, yeah.
Something crazy like that for a source of energy?
Well,
and what did we do? We created a movie and got scared.
Yeah, that was Jane Fonda's, I remember. Speaking of getting scared, Germany, I think they built, I don't know, a few nuclear power plants. After Fukushima had their partial meltdown a few years back, Germany decided that they were going to close their nuclear power plants because nuclear is scary. So they've done that, and now they're having problems when the solar power doesn't come up to speed, and they have to buy power, and it's put them in a bit of a precarious spot.
Good.
Yeah, I was good for them. Yeah.
What you get when you do stupid things.
Yeah, it's so beyond the pale. If you want to argue poisoning the environment, you want to argue radiation, you can come at me, bro, with this any way you would like to about how nuclear power is bad, and it's just unfounded, except for, you know, the word nuclear sounds scary to people.
Yeah, until you realize how many nuclear-powered naval ships are out, they've been out there for decades just fine. And, you know, I often wondered about, you know, instead of making giant plants that would probably take forever, why couldn't we make a lot more? It's curious to me, could you stick a bunch of aircraft carrier size nuclear power plants sprinkled around and, you know, spread out? I don't know if that's spreading the risk or, you know, it'd be an interesting conversation to have from a, you know, debate, so to speak.
Well, one of the things I learned in my 20s, there's stories that are obviously true or mostly true, and then there's stories I really, really want to be true, but, you know, because I want it to be true, that's probably less likely they are. But there's been a bunch of stories in the last year or two about startups building portable, mass-produced nuclear batteries or nuclear reactors. That'd be freaking amazing if that actually happens. That would be really, really cool.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Yeah, it's the same thing with Musk and his rocket thing. You know, once you do something that's really so far ahead of everybody else, the rest of the system just kind of drags you back and says, no, not so fast. Hang on, no.
Yeah.
We don't go real fast around here. You're not fitting in with the rest of the crowd.
Right.
Yeah, I read today that FAA has delayed more launches of the Starship because of an environmental impact assessment that was supposed to be done in 2 days, but now it's going to be another 2 or 3 months at least. So that'll show you.
Yeah.
Which one is this one here? Well, this is the loading article. It's very popular this time of year with the internet being down. So speaking of the Navy and nuclear power plants and all of this, you sent me this link as one of your sort of outstanding, you know, articles. The Navy's fusion plans could produce a world-shattering weapon.
Yeah, this is a crazy one.
Hey, isn't it?
Especially the one, PowerPoint slide.
Yeah.
Wherever the hell that is, down near the bottom.
Yeah, potential uses, yes.
Yeah. There's some hilarious ones in there.
Fusion-driven aircraft jet engines.
It'll make the hydrogen bomb seem like a firecracker.
Yeah. Okay. Fusion-induced intergalactic space drives.
Hey, shoot for the moon, man.
Best PowerPoint ever. You know, some guy going, oh, they're going to love this. Yeah, you know, you just know there's somebody doing this one. This is going to be great.
And look at the bold, the one bullet that's bold.
Yes.
Potential for commercial use. Yes.
Who doesn't want fusion powered intergalactic space drives? I mean, I'll take one of those. That'd be great.
Yeah.
This article is funny on so many levels. You know, the rumor is that this is just sort of a head fake from the Navy saying, bullshit, you guys believe, if you believe this, then go spend a bunch of money on something that's impossible. But heck if I know. If this is disinformation, it's such an odd thing to put out. I mean, why don't you just put something kind of reasonable out that people would fall into? This is like way out in left field.
Yeah, and I didn't, you know, like, you can't click on the PowerPoint, but I'd love to click on the space-time modification weapon. Well, wait, what?
You already did. Next week, you clicked on this already. There was some science fiction movie where the MacGuffin, the thing they found that was a, maybe it was Galaxy Quest. You push the button and time rolls back like 3 or 4 seconds, and you get a chance to play out the last 3 or 4 seconds. Who am I to get in the way of a space-time modification? But not, I'm all for it, yeah. So yeah, this is going to be interesting. This has been sort of trickling out along with the other kind of weird pseudoscience-y stories of the UAP thing, Project Galileo from MIT, the Navy video, the fighters chasing little blips around. Some sort of in search of type weird stuff, and it's fun. It's fun just to comment on. Really, it doesn't have to be true at all. It's just fun just to joke around about.
Yeah, now I was fortunate to learn about the patent process when we were making TogetherSoft a little more robust in the eyes of potential suitors. We decided to grab some of our what we thought might be uniqueness and do some software patents. So I learned a patent doesn't really mean anything until it's actually tested and under litigation. As while the patent office may or may not reject it, it's still not, there's nothing that says the patent office is the end all of being able to adjudicate your patent as being viable or logical or possible. It's a little bit like saying a peer reviewed paper. Okay, that and a patent are about the same. That's just the starting point. It doesn't mean anything other than you went through some efforts. Maybe you had a bunch of buddies peer review it. I actually had some fun clients that were sort of joking about what peer review really means versus what people think it is. You know, it's the start, not the end.
Right. Well, you know, there's a provision in the patent law, I think, for classified patents. I think of a lot of the Manhattan Project stuff was patented at the time, but it was top secret so that you couldn't, that way the 10, 20 years later on, they could pick up some royalties on it. It's weird. You know, the patent, there's a technical requirement for the thing to actually work. You can't do a perpetual motion machine and all this other stuff. But if there is a top secret process and the chief of naval research comes to you and says, hey, you need to patent this, I think he wins. You know, it's like he trumps everybody else there, I think.
Yeah.
I look forward to there are alien overlords from there, right? The FBI seized heirlooms, coins, cash from hundreds of safe deposit box in Beverly Hills, despite knowing some of these belong to honest citizens. It's, as far as I can tell, they just kind of showed up and took everything because somebody there had done something that was against the law, so the whole freaking place got raided.
Correct. Yeah, it's, you know, it's sad. I mean, I guess the FBI was, you know, had mud in its eye or had a black eye back in the days?
J. Edgar.
Hoover, yeah. But boy, I think it's got a big black eye these days too. Things along like stuff like this, the you know how they instigated the Michigan governor kidnapping was almost all FBI. You know that kind of crap. It's just what they're doing now is you know, weaponizing these entities. You should be proud and independent, and you know, but they're human.
They are human, and it's not that we don't support, you know, getting rid of criminals. That's not the thing. The problem is that we're supposedly to have a checks and balance system that doesn't seem to have any checks or balances that I can determine.
Because, this really was the company who owned the safe deposit box did something. And the safe deposit box weren't even part of the something, but they just took it all. And I think the couple of people that this was about, I think that also support reason.com are like, we still don't know where our stuff is.
Yeah. It was like this child of a sheriff in Michigan, I think, or maybe it was Illinois, was driving his dad's pickup, brand new pickup truck, and he had several $1,000s cash. They They pulled him over, took the cash and his dad's truck, who was the sheriff of some county. Took that guy like 2 or 3 years to get his truck back. That's not a health. I keep seeing signs that these are not this. We don't live in a healthy system anymore.
Yeah, and even the what they did with the January 6th trespassers. You know, it's like they threw them in a dungeon and threw out the key. There's people have, you know, for trespassing.
Yeah, I've stayed away from that story because of that big orange-headed dude that's associated.
Yeah.
Ronald the Clown. I forget what his name is. Yeah. Anyway, he was on TV a lot a while back.
Right.
But yeah, the thing is that Valerie Plame, going back, I don't know, 20 years or so, was outed as a CIA agent, and there was similar big kerfuffle about, you know, who outed her, what should we do, and I have the same opinion with her as I do with this case, and that is if somebody broke the law, we should prosecute them.
Yeah.
To the extent the law allows. As it turned out with Valerie Plame, it was not the evil other party that had outed them. It was actually some member of their own party who was at the State Department. So many times these things seem like a big deal into Western civilization, but it's just a bunch of a political smoke and mirrors going on more than anything else.
Yeah.
You look back on the history stuff. I'm going to try not to go too far down the head-on-fire lane here. But you look back through history, and every sort of system of governance, the FBI, the Secret Service, they have all sort of felt like they're a law to themselves at the end of the day. And we've taken measures to try to fix that, but I haven't really seen anything significant since maybe the Church Commission back in the mid-70s. We're just, in fact, after 9/11, as I understand it, there's some secret presidential orders that pretty much, we just pretty much do whatever we want to do.
Yeah, like the Patriot Act was properly scheduled to sunset, but then sort of improperly, they keep re-upping it. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think what people don't realize is not that whether we're at war or not or whether these things are serious, it's that some forms of government cannot last. It's not that we don't like it or we like it. It's just that, you can't run a government over a period of decades when you're kind of got everything locked down, this sort of corrupt, we win every game kind of mode we're in right now. And that's just not going to work for us.
It's a great point.
Yeah.
Somehow Rome fell. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think to the point is that we probably work best. Try to tell people why the United States works at all. And the reason it has worked for hundreds of years is because we have a federated system in layers, and each layer can be controlled by a different political party, and then each layer split into three other groups: the judiciary, the executive, and the legislative. So by having that sort of distributed system the way it is, it's not that it's not corrupt; it's that it's corrupt in different ways, and it sort of balances itself out over time. But I see the end of that probably in the 70s or 80s. Stop really making a difference which party you voted for. They had one or two things they wanted to do because there were those guys, but the rest of it was pretty much the same stuff.
Yeah, I would agree. I often would say it's just different speeds that going over the cliff.
Yeah, one of the things I don't say enjoy, but I was interested in watching was recent President Obama when he came to office. He had, he was quite a firebrand, a great speaker, had a lot of support. But then after he became president, to hear his supporters, something went wrong with him. And you get the idea that, politics at some level is just a big kind of, magic act. But then when you actually get into actually running things, it's like, okay, well, now that was just a bunch of bullshit. They believe that, but let's just not tell them. We'll go on. And people figure that out.
Yeah, the deep bureaucracies that are there. Presidents come and go, but we're still here.
Yes, and many, there are thousands of people, not just a few, but thousands of people who run very large departments, hundreds of millions of dollars each, that feel that same way, that, hey, you guys, you can come and go every 4 years, we're still here.
Yep, exactly.
I read somewhere there's over 100,000 people with top secret special compartmentalized intelligence clearance, over 100,000 in, I think there's 50 or more agencies around the D.C. area. That's insane. There's no way to even get that in your head as far as what they're all keeping secret from one another.
Yeah, not to mention the salaries and State Department and all of the ambassador residences where they live and how they live and the parties they throw. Yeah, there's just a ton of ton of waste, fraud, and abuse.
And I think the important thing to hit on this, and we've done this several times, I want to try to take the role of somebody who may not be here, maybe Mark or Eric or somebody. You know, this is properties of large systems of people who have been around for a while. The fact that these large systems of people happen to represent the government, in our example, General Electric went through the same thing. Every big company develops into little fiefdoms, and they get fragile and can't actually adapt in changing conditions. It's not a, it's nothing to do with the United States or our politics. It's just a property of people.
Yeah, I'm generally against or skeptical of large organizations of any kind.
Well, you know, there was a thing done with, I can't remember the study, it was about charities, NGOs. And it made the point that, you know, say you've got a charity to help people without shoes. At some point, after you grow through your first couple $1 million or whatever, you become the charity who's most interested in making sure people without shoes are heard from, which is a different goal than making sure people have shoes. The goal of the organization becomes its own self-sustainment instead of the actual goal of the organization. So you'll see during the Vietnam War, Army generals famously said, off the record, hey, look, we can't fight Vietnam. It'll destroy the Army. And he was absolutely right, because you can't take a, you know, land warfare unit for Europe and stick it in the jungle without destroying the land warfare part. But yet, at the same time, he was like, okay, well, you know, this is my organization. It is more important than the actual thing we're expecting the organization to do. It's like, yeah. Same old, my friend. YouTube CEO receives free expression award. Oh, wow. Because, and he was mocked, because YouTube actually supports the people who give out these awards. Are we awesome, or are we awesome, huh?
Yeah, that's the hypocrisy and irony is amazing.
Wow, these guys are awesome. If you don't believe that they're awesome, you should ask them. They just got an award recently.
The awesome award.
The awesome award, most awesome. This next one gets my sort of WTF award. This year, we saw the launch of the first wooden satellite.
How'd it do? Did it stay glued together?
You see people 100 years from now, I was born in a log cabin satellite going around Neptune. It's like, you know, that was the thing back in the 1800s. If you're born in a wooden house, it was a... So maybe it'll be like the latest chic thing for astronauts.
Yeah, CubeSat thing is cool, that's for sure.
Yes, and we do have a problem with a lot of stuff flying around uncontrolled that Russians are helping actually make worse of a problem with their thing. But yeah, wooden satellites may work. It's just, I would never expected we would come back to cellulose fibers.
Well, it might be, you know, Scandinavians probably make the really nice, high-quality birch plywood.
Yeah.
You know, clear, no knots.
Well, yeah, and who wouldn't want to get, like, a package from IKEA with one of those sofa, you can assemble your own wooden satellite.
And a little place to mail it to, and then it gets launched.
Yeah, well, hey, very cool. Do it yourself. Now, this is the one you flagged. It was also very cool. Farming robot kills 100,000 weeds per hour with freaking lasers, man. Yeah, huh?
Bring it on.
Yeah, farmers farming robots with lasers.
Because weeding does suck.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I'd like to see this in action. That's got to be pretty cool. The lasers are crossing over. You know, when we were kids coming up in the 70s, 80s, lasers were this. They just sort of made shit up to say it was a laser. But now, we're actually starting to see some really painful, powerful type lasers that are being deployed. This is a new world. And the thing is, it's EMF, electromagnetic directed weapons, are not going to work the way that we saw them in all those Star Wars movies. That just, it doesn't, there's no pulse of light that goes out or anything. It's more like a flashlight. Okay, just give me my blaster. I'm a happy guy.
Yeah.
So this next one is sort of, One of these I flagged as being one of the more important. Yes, don't scroll away. God, freaking beauty. This is something I figured is kind of the...
I donate, all right?
So. It doesn't matter. You still get it anyway. This is one of these things that kind of made me do the most head-scratching over the past year, and we've had some pretty cool articles. This is panpsychism. We talked a little bit about this last week. You know, I'm working this third book on kind of AI and organizational learning and how that works. And part of that is like sort of researching what is consciousness and learning. And that's kind of boring stuff. But you get down to the end of this and they're thinking that, well, you know, consciousness may actually be irreductible at present. It may be part of reality around us. And for the physicists hearing that, they're like, okay, so you're saying a proton can think. That's not what they're saying. What they're really saying is that some things we analyze best from, you know, here's what we know it does for sure. Let's figure out the pieces that do that, which is most physics works that way. But some things we work best, like we did with atoms originally, where we just say we stipulate there's a very, very small thing that behaves this way. We can't identify what it is. And then we put that together to figure out how we get emergent behavior. So panpsychism just says, hey, look, consciousness is at such a low level. Who knows? Who cares? We can't start there. It just has to be emergent from something else. Fascinating. And I think that the kicker, which made it the most head-scratching to me, they were talking about people who had split brains because of epilepsy. And they asked the doctors, like, hey, does one brain know about the other one? And the answer is they're both conscious. They both believe they're people. But they don't know about the other one. So his thing, it follows rationally that we may be part of a larger consciousness that we're unaware of. I'm still kind of working my way through that. How would you, do your neurons know about your brain? And they, no. So, I just get paid for these ones and zeros. Put the little ones and zeros next to the little zeros and a couple other ones and good work.
Yeah. Is there a control system, you know, some higher center that knows more? Yeah, it's kind of a fascinating concept.
In many ways, because if it were a higher level of consciousness, by definition, we would be unable to reason about it. So it's, one would expect for it to be self-aware and be able to reason about its own existence, but we would not be able to grasp that. And that's full head explosion mode.
Yeah, definitely. It's how do we know? Why do we know?
Well, you know, we talk a lot. We've done politics and large organizations of people and stuff. We talk a lot about, you know, we put these things together and these things usually happen. You know, you and I just talked about this. And so it wouldn't surprise me if consciousness isn't sort of that same type of thing. We can't directly say that you do this, this is going to happen. We can say in general, these patterns of large numbers of these things usually sort of assemble in this sort of fashion.
Well, certainly from the one side of social development that John Turley and I, well, he's exposed me to anyway. You know, starting with the, you know, children, babies, etc., the I. I mean, that's the first thing you sort of know about is me. And it takes a while for a baby to understand about others. So yeah, there's some kind of emergent sort of forming and developing of those sort of concepts about myself and my mom, or, you know, and others, the wider others, you know, so on the way to even higher levels of perceiving, you know, the systems of the world and things like that. So yeah, there is certainly a developmental path that appears.
Yeah, well, you can think of
what forms that or how does that work? Yeah, I don't know.
I guess maybe you could think of that in terms of differentiating forms of abstraction. So at first it's everything is everything, and then it's I am everything, and then it's I am everything except for this other thing. And over time, we still keep these abstractions in our mind, but we just get better at, like, you know, this is a, you know, 17 different qualifiers to make sure it's this type of thing instead of some other. You know, maybe that's, you know, everything is stuff. It's where you start with, and then you end up with, you know, here's how quantum mechanics works. but that is the point. See, this panpsychism really is, to me, much more about how you're going to do that analysis than is what the answer is. It's kind of funny to hear the feedback from physicists who are angry with it, because most of what they do right now is kind of, I don't want to say bullshit, but okay, it's not grounded in a, you know, solid theory. We don't know what gravity is. We think we know. We've got an idea. We don't know for sure. We don't know but dark energy, dark mass. There's dozens of things we really do not have any idea about. We've got some good guesses. And so for them, them to get upset about this, that consciousness is part of reality, I don't think they need to take a look in their own shop first before they're picking on the other guys.
Like when I read about the James Webb telescope, and it said something like, it's supposed to peer further into history of the universe within about 100 million years of the beginning. And even that, well, that's based on the Big Bang theory. And it's kind of funny to know, well, how sure are you of that? Yeah. How sure are you that you're really only 100, it's like, I forget, it's an insane number of billions of years that it should be able to appear. And it's only 100 million. So it sounds like the order of magnitude is, it's like we went a mile and just another inch, you'd be at the edge. Or,
Yeah, like a mine. We're at the end here. Yeah, you ever watch the TV show Lost?
No.
So Lost went for around 7 or 8 seasons. It's okay. J.J. Abrams, they did a bunch of stuff. They had bad guys, good guys, and they moved it. But they were determined to keep it logically consistent so that it would go somewhere. And at the end, even though we basically been told about magic and science and all this stuff, at the end, you finally get to meet the good and evil in this universe, and it's just a couple brothers sitting on an island.
Really?
And I think, as I understand the point, is not that they were trying to cheat people out. It's like, even if we told you the answer, it wouldn't make sense to you anyway. So it's our insistence that somehow these concepts fit into some sort of thing that we understand. And I'm not saying to give up science. I'm just saying that, it might not make sense to us currently. It may take a while.
Yeah, that's a good point. Sometimes you just got to deal with it. Just is.
It just is. Shut up and do the math, as the physicists talk about. You, why is a good answer? Teleology is like, why does this happen because of that, and what's the ultimate goal? I mean, these aren't totally stupid questions, but if you can't get something out of them today, you probably should be doing something else. Really. Let's see if we've got any other ones here. Oh yeah, so a candidate for biggest horse manure article is the hypersonics. Have you been following any of this hypersonics?
A little bit.
But for the last 2 years or so, the Department of Defense is saying, golly, we haven't been doing much hypersonics. Those Chinese folks are going to get ahead of us.
Right, yeah.
And now the Chinese and Russians both have them, and it's, oh my goodness, why aren't we doing this? And that narrative on its own kind of holds together, but damn, hypersonics we've been doing since this X-15. So this really kind of came from nowhere. That's not a viable thing to say.
Yeah, I think I even saw something where the Chinese used something we had developed a long time ago.
And like I said, it may be a threat. I'm not saying it is or isn't, but it sounds like, well, golly, we don't have any big expensive programs that have the word hypersonic on top of them. So we got to spend some more money here, bud, okay?
Right. The Senate has to get off their ass and make some stupid DARPA-funded program that sucks money.
So meanwhile, Elon Musk is speaking of the Starship, building the Starship thing, and as part of that, it's made of stainless steel and can re-enter without a lot of heat tiles or much work. It'd go anywhere in the world, 90 minutes or less. That, my friend, is about as hypersonic as it's ever going to get. We're not going to push past that. So what are we going to build? We need like another hypersonic stealth fighter to compete with this like $100 million rocket thing. Did you read about the SLS system? They're pushing off for another year now.
No.
Yeah. So that was the thing that was supposed to take us to the moon and all that. We're going to reuse all the space shuttle technology. And hell, they're not having launched the first rocket yet, and it's already been delayed 5 years and whatever budget.
Who's running that project?
Northrop Grumman, NASA, and I think Lockheed Martin. So it's the sort of main three wonky projects there. Who's running that? A lot of people are running. Who's responsible? Not anybody really.
Right. That's classic giant. Let's make sure we involve everybody so that, you know, we don't piss anybody off and, you know, keep funneling money into the industrial, military industrial complex.
Yeah, and you would think, you know, okay, guys, you want to spend billions, fine. I don't like it, but go spend all the money you want. But good God, we know these same forms of errors. Look at the space shuttle project. It just, look, we do this over and over again. Why do we seem unable to stop doing this?
Because it goes back to the giant organization.
Yes.
Yes. The incompetence. The incompetence of money.
Yeah, and it goes back to what we talked about Agile and CICD many times, is that we're very good at identifying large, scary risks and, you know, throwing money and people at those large, scary risks, but we're very bad at sort of figuring out risk-reward and how to best balance all that. Okay, I think that is about it. John, you been watching any movies or anything, any Christmas movies over the holidays?
No. I mean, I did see the perfectly timed both ending portions of the Die Hard movies.
Ooh. Ooh.
So those are nice and cheesy, like the the aircraft scene. He comes up out of a grate under the barely gets out in time from being run over by the landing gear.
Yeah. My wife was like, why would they have a manhole cover on the runway? Okay, so you can stick your head out, see what's going on, hey.
Right. Look, there's a big plane.
Hey.
Yeah, because typically, you know, runways are either grooved for water or they're domed slightly.
Yes.
So that, you know, so the water would run off a little more slowly. But yeah, pick one. Pretty sure there's not like a storm drainage.
Yeah, you really do not want to put a hole underneath the thing where the 100,000-pound thing comes and lands. It's not
right.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure that metal would get dished over time.
Yeah, and they've got all these little subways you go through underneath the airport, and there's a whole thing. It's like a little warren of caves under there.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can't ask yourself. You know, even the first movie, and I love the first movie, by the way, but you just can't go too logical on these action adventures because it doesn't hold up very well.
Yeah, but I do remember seeing, you know, because I literally jumped in near the end. I said, oh yeah, I remember now the blue tape on the clips.
Yes.
The red tape. Oh yeah, those guys are actually bad guys. And it's, yeah, it's kind of funny.
And well, then you're like, okay, so first of all, where are the snowmobiles in Virginia? Because I've lived here my entire life, never seen one snowmobile. And second of all, like, where are you going to go after you, like, kill your own fellow countrymen in some sort of armed combat? You're going to, like, go to Panama? I mean, where's the spot you're going to go hide from that one?
Yeah.
But the best movies, they take you a little bit at a time, and once you've sort of bought in, the director knows that they can keep pushing past that, and everybody's cool. It's when they hit you too hard with the bullshit too soon. It's like, oh no. And then they've lost you for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, and a lot of blood. A lot of blood. He's always covered in blood. It's hilarious.
I like that. One of the reasons I like the first Die Hard is Alan Rickman, of course, first off. But really, the script is so compact. You watch the first 10 or 20 minutes, every line in that movie is related to several other things that happens later in the movie. The guy makes fists with his toes in the airport. He's a policeman. It all perfectly sets itself up. So you can tell there's been a lot of work done on it.
It's like a Seinfeld episode.
Seinfeld episode.
All those little threads tied back.
Yeah, that you think are unrelated somehow come together at the very end. Yeah. I've been watching the last season of Expanse. It's about the way it's been so far. I think I want to go back and rewatch the whole thing because see, it's one of the shows I really feel like I should like more than I actually do. And I don't know why. Maybe it's my own failings that I'm not appreciating enough.
I, not that this is at all Christmas, but I did drop in on part of a Breaking Bad episode early on. I was like, oh, is that Jesse? Yeah, it's Jesse. I said, And I said, it's, you know, I'm watching Breaking Bad. So it was really early on, but just the production value, little things like, he's at school and just the shuffling of his papers, he's pretending to grade. And well, you know, like, well, I think his one son, you know, they'll be going home in 20 minutes, but just even the audio of him flipping the papers and just little things like that. And then other elements of the scene with, you know, just a small 20 minute session. I was like, yeah, this is really well done. Yes. It's such a well done, just small, little, subtle things I never really noticed before.
I love the story of how they make movies and TV shows, because to me, the story of these thousands of people getting together and making something that cool, that's better than the thing itself, really. That's how they pull this together. I watched Meet the Ricardos, which is on Amazon Prime this month. It's a Aaron Sorkin written thing about the Lucille Ball show.
Oh, cool.
And I grew up with my parents watching that, and so I have some familiarity with it. But it was the same thing. It was like these people, they may not be pleasant, but they're all professionals. They understand each little detail of what they're supposed to be doing. And it all kind of comes together the right way. It's magic when it happens, but dang, even with all the attention to detail and having the right people in place, most times it doesn't happen then anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
So yeah, Lucy, I grew up with Lucille Ball off and on. You know, she did some later shows, and Desi,
absolutely,
of course, was supposed to be the drinking womanizer. And looking at Sorkin's treatment of it, she had a lot of talent, and Desi Arnaz recognized that and married her. He said, "You're going to be great." She was getting ready to just go off into the sunset. He said, no, you guys got to pay attention to her because she's awesome. And damn, if he wasn't right, she was awesome. So then, yeah, he ended up being second banana pretty quick.
Yeah.
It was a painfully flawed people somehow coming together at the same time and doing something really, really cool. Those are good stories.
A good friend of mine that we worked together for a lot, he often called, he likened what we did as like the Hollywood model, where you'd assemble a team to work on a project and build stuff. And it could be a different team the next time, but a lot like a movie. And it takes a lot of moving parts and a lot of coordination and a lot of people all committed. And sometimes, and we had quite a few opportunities to make magic. But it is kind of fascinating that sort of different way of thinking about it.
I feel that a lot of reconstruction I got in my software development career early on actually prevented me from doing a lot of really good stuff, because it made me think of software as being like, you know, project management, as being sort of this logical system. All these different metaphors I was sort of given didn't really apply to the actual work itself once I got there.
Ah, interesting.
I wrote my first book. I wrote a fiction book, and it sucked. It was perfect. I mean, technically, it was good. I was really well constructed, but I had some problems with how to put together the plot. And I did also research into how to write stories. And at the end, the best advice I heard was from a guy who said, look, understand deep in your heart how you want the audience to feel. And then the rest of that has to support that. The plotting, everything else has to support that. And I'm like, well, holy shit, this is great product development advice. Understand exactly how you want the new user to feel picking up your product. And now make them feel that way.
Right. That's a great point. It's like, what outcomes are you looking to achieve?
Not only outcomes, I mean the actual visceral, emotional feel to it. I think a lot of times we want to argue testable features when the actual test is, damn, this is cool.
Yeah, I'm thinking of that as an outcome. Like, you know, an NPS of 10 or something, or wow the audience.
There was an article said, like, was it sizzle, or was a whole book on like make your customers sizzle or something. You probably don't want to make your customers sizzle, but
no. Versus sell the sizzle, not the steak.
There's sell the sizzle, not the steak, and there's it's not qualifiers, enhancers. The force fails me right now, but there was a book series on take the literal requirements and then translate them into how you want the emotional impact to be.
Well, I wonder, going back to your sort of feeling you know, off course in the beginning, possibly by the education or the system that you were in. It just made me think, okay, so I was an engineer doing engineering things with hardware and testing and whatever, and then sort of stumbled on this thing called software as an adjunct to different kinds of tools to allow things to proceed and for me to solve problems. And I was never formally trained. I mean, I had a couple of dopey classes at Ohio State, you know, like two programming classes, maybe Fortran. I remember using cards one year, and then finally we got screens where you could type something in and it remember, you know. So really, really nothing from other than an exposure to there's something called software and there's computers. And I wonder if that different angle was enough so that I typically was self-selecting what I wanted to learn to try to solve certain problems. You know, there's something then that I can't quite formulate. That's why I'm just tossing it out as a conversation starter.
My experience was kind of similar. I'm self-taught as well. I just had a pretty good aptitude for coding. And so, I would be a manager at a restaurant. I'd write a profit and loss system. I would be a clerk at a fuel shop. I'd end up writing a fleet management system. Everything I ended up doing, I wrote programs because I was just good at writing programs. I think that the problem is that I think a lot of writers of stories and articles focus on the mechanics of writing instead of the actual impact on the user. And I think the same thing happens to us programmers. We focus on the mechanics of how programs come together instead of the actual real world. Here's a person using it. What's it doing for them?
I see. Yeah.
You know, that was the part that I was hidden from you, because whenever you got a job, and I know better because I got some jobs where I was working directly with people that were impacted. But as I moved forward, as soon as you got into any sort of, I'll say big money, you know, six figures or more, you ended up in some spot where you're not there. There's some wall or series of walls between you and the actual emotional impact. And then you just start inwardly focusing on mechanics and lambdas and pointers, and we've got a whole bunch of stuff we can spend decades and decades sort of fussing about, and none of it means a damn thing to the person using the app.
Right. Yeah, I guess I've always tried to fight that. Maybe been successful most of the time.
I just think it's weird that the crossover to me between humanities and programming, since I consider myself a writer and I end up doing programming anyway, we see people. I remember I used to get Writer Magazine, and you would see these articles like top 7 adjectives used to get query letters accepted, you know? And it would be like, you know, quick or fast or whatever. You'd read these adjectives. And it took me maybe, you know, a dozen or two of these things to realize, you know, this is a total bullshit article to read. Total bullshit. You can't come at quality from a quantitative standpoint. It doesn't work like that at all. And so, yeah, we focus on things we can count, because counting is something everybody can do. We can all count, but it's just a small part of actually what any sort of value is.
Yeah, and yeah, if there are a few things that we can help folks understand in our industry, this is starting to get at it in terms of, and if you're trying to solve the problem of doing the best we can to delight our customers, then you know, it's important what we're talking about. If you're just out to have fun, coding's a job, I want to learn new technology, you know, the latest whiz-bang, lambdas or Angular or, you know, whatever, then that the importance of satisfying the customer might not be number one in terms of, I might also like to do just cool coding stuff. So yeah, I've always struggled with trying to help teams that I work with be delighted in satisfying the customer. And that's what should motivate you, and that's what should be awesome, not necessarily some shiny new widgets. I mean, do that once in a while. I like them too, but
I think the there's some metrics you can use. One of the things I look for in my own work is if I end up doing something that's not as technically cool but has its bigger, greater impact, then I would have been disappointed for some reason. Like, I didn't do the technically hard thing. But now I'm more like, okay, now I know that because I'm making those choices, I'm actually focused outside my own little sphere of the universe. And that's tough. I mean, it's just tough. We spend so little time actually talking about how our programming changes the people around us. And the rest of the time, it's just how many top seven variable names used in Visual Basic. It's all the same bullshit over here that it was in the writing world.
Yeah.
Lucky.
I saw somebody tweet.
I was going to say, we're lucky. What we do is we're extremely lucky, and I hope other generations will have this privilege, in that we're actually in charge of creating these naming systems of things that interrelate to one another as we do our work. Domain model, if you want to call it that, or whatever. Most other fields of study, they already give you a taxonomy set up, and here's how to categorize this and another thing, and this means that, this means this. We actually, for the most part, have to figure that shit out as we go along.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, in other words, if we were civil engineers designing a bridge, pretty much the equations, the nomenclature, the variable names, the, you know, the various constants and factors and testing, you know, there's probably, just going to go out on a limb, probably 90% is already defined, and it's just applying it to this problem.
And that gets back to that, what I was talking about, being able to tell sort of whether I'm doing a good job or not, is that, and what we do, if we were looking at the same bridge problem, we're able to back out and say, okay, what's the real need here? And someone might say, well, okay, I need to put some groceries, you know, to my house every week or so. And maybe we build a giant catapult that tosses them over, you know, I'm just making something silly up. But the thing is that what we come up with, if we're doing a good job, should seem kind of silly until you actually build the damn thing and it does everything you want it to and you walk away. But most every other discipline, you're going in to write a bridge, you know, build a bridge, you're building a freaking bridge, and it's going to be, have all the parameters and names of every other bridge before and after it.
Right.
So
we are a very, very young discipline.
Yes. Yeah, I'm amazed every year I'll see somebody do some stuff in computer science, and I'm able to sort of follow along because I read the literature, but I'm like, oh, wow, we're still figuring a bunch of stuff out.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I need another doubly linked list is kind of my joke.
Yeah, know? Well, see, you don't need to make new nails either, really, just... I don't, whatever happened to the triply linked list? They're not good enough? People want to use those?
I think they're a function table processor lookups.
You know, it's funny because, was it RDF? There's a relational data format. There's a way of storing stuff. It's like a domain, entity, attribute, and then you've got a number. So it's three triple identifier, then a value. You could actually just build so many things we do. You could just like take it apart to some point and build the entire universe out of that one thing if you wanted to. Cool stuff.
Yeah, there's some very atomic things that are very useful. Yeah,
I remember the first rules-based code I wrote. I was got through with it. I'm like, hey, you know, I can put any kind of rule in here. Oh my god! And it's like, whoa, you know, I can put anything in here. It will do any. I can control the universe from this little console. Fun stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, let me do my goodbye thing. Hang on a second. You have lost another hour of your precious time joining us with Nerd Roundup this week. And we're really dang glad you came by. We're here every week. We're going to be on Discord. If you get a chance to check us out on Discord, I'll put a link in the links online. I'm Daniel Markham. I will see you on the internet.